Finally, after 5 years of product failures, my 35th offer actually worked. And my next 55 products generated over $11 million in sales in just 4 years. But after seeing the flaws in my business, I decided to shut it all down and restart from scratch, as us entrepreneurs do. Follow me and the other capitalist pig-loving entrepreneurs as I continue my journey towards $100 million in sales. I'm your host, Steve J. Larson, and welcome to Season 2 of Sales Funnel Radio.
What's up, everyone? It's Steve Larson, and I wanted to do a special video today with good friend and business partner of mine on something that I don't think you guys really know that we're doing. And a lot of you have asked, like, why aren't you publishing as much? How come you haven't been? I mean, I know it's been a solid, I really have not put out that much content in the last year. It's probably the least amount I've put out. And my business felt it, so keep publishing. I'm not giving you license to do. I've also been going off and doing kind of a dream of mine for a long time. And frankly, started dabbling in it. And then Raleigh showed up. And you and I met. So welcome to the channel, to all of it.
Thank you.
Appreciate you here. I wanted to bring on Raleigh here and kind of chat a little bit more about what we've been doing. What we've been chatting about and doing is M&A and mergers and acquisitions. And I remember, I'll just say, the first time I was in college when I realized that's what I wanted to do, was some aspect would be some sort of small business consulting, but then also buying and selling and fixing and flipping businesses, basically. And I had, like, the way you and I started doing business together seems so natural. I don't actually remember totally how it started. So anyway, for people who don't know you, could you just tell everyone kind of what you do?
I started as a M&A lawyer in New York and in Dallas. I was working for big private equity firms, public companies, and law at big firms. You do a lot of mergers and acquisitions, and capital market work is kind of the same. So companies that are public, that are looking to do debt financings or equity financings, they usually use the same law group. So I was at the biggest M&A law firm in the world, a firm called Skadden Arps, worked in Times Square. I did that for a little bit less than a year. And you see enough closing statements and purchase and sale agreements for like $20 billion plus deals, and you're getting paid a number that's much, much smaller than that. And you're like, seems like I should be in these deals, not just advising these deals. And so I wanted to figure out a way to do it for myself. And so I quit practicing law and I bought an interest in a trampoline park in 2016. And then we did some acquisitions for escape rooms, axe throwing businesses, a couple bars. We were in the family entertainment space. And I became the CEO of that in 2016 and then sold it for a little less than $30 million in 2021. In that time, kind of in tandem with that, my wife was doing a digital product business and she got connected into the kind of digital marketing, ClickFunnels, funnel world. And so we started going to some of those events and it was so foreign to me. It was just so different than what my background was. And that's how I met you, and we, you know, you helped us a ton in my wife's business, kind of using the power of funnels and what it can do to, you know, customer acquisition processes. After I sold my business, I felt like there's this digital business world that the rest of the world isn't really privy to just yet. And so I thought it would be cool to start using M&A and kind of the OG principles that some of the richest people in the world do into this new kind of emerging market of courses, content, you know, cash flowing businesses. And so that's what we've been doing.
It's probably the most fun I've had in business in like probably 3 years, you know.
Yeah.
Just, and to watch the way that you structured, which I want to go through the deal that, you know, I kind of did, you know, most recently in a bit, but like to watch the way you structure it is like, what I think people look at me when I'm in full funnel flow, like the world disappears, man. It's pure focus. It's like I'm watching Einstein just like piece things together out of the thin air. It was the coolest thing to watch because you see one version of it on Shark Tank, you know? And unless you've been around it, you don't really know how that whole world works. And I think my world from internet marketing land and world, we don't really talk about this much. We don't think about enterprise value very much. My first real experience in it was when I was going through my divorce and they were evaluating my business and I was crossing, you know, I told you this is one of the stories you and I bonded over, I remember, because I was like, I was crossing $8 million in sales, but my company was only valued at $500,000.
Right.
And which was kind of a gut punch. And I was like, oh my gosh. He said, Steven, Mr. Larson, you have no recurring revenue and you are the business. And I was like, crap, I don't have a business. I have like a really clever promotion that's been going on for years.
Sure.
And then I started seeing what causes value. Enter Raleigh. That's kind of how it happened
I think there's so much, you know, a lot of people get started on an entrepreneurial path as an alternative to doing a career, and kind of the very common entry way into that is do what you're passionate about. And so that for a lot of people, that starts as kind of their North Star of how they start into entrepreneurialism is, what am I passionate about? And I think that's a great place to start at. But then the next level of that is, how do I turn this into an asset? And there's some give and take in that process of turning your business into an asset that isn't necessarily always driven by you doing what you're passionate about day in and day out. And I think that's where a lot of entrepreneurs get themselves messed up, is because they're not thinking about, what is the enterprise value? How much is this thing worth if I ever sell it? And so you're kind of on a razor's edge that you don't even understand that you're on, because you're overly involved in too many of the processes. And so a lot of entrepreneurs get themselves into that because they're, you know, when you hear people talk about turning your business into a sellable asset, in their current circumstance, they have no desire to sell. So they feel like it's inapplicable to them. And then
sure,
in a moment, your whole life can change. And then you want to sell, but you haven't laid the foundation to do it. And then you get, you know, like a situation like in your divorce where it's untradeable, because you wouldn't sell it for what the market would pay you for. So you end up holding it, and you know, a lot of things fall by the wayside that way.
Yeah. And there's a easy and natural tendency to think that the amount of money the business has made is what it is worth, and it's not true at all. And I feel like the piece that is really key for my world to understand is that there, just like you said, there's being an entrepreneur where the entrepreneur, the entrepreneur is a verb, right? You're creating the value out of other things in a unique way. And so you entrepreneur the offer. You entrepreneur the project out into the world. But eventually what you entrepreneur on has to shift from the product to the business. And you have to like ascend from entrepreneur to business owner, and those transitions, those pieces. And I think that's been such a fun side of the coin to watch you go do your thing in when we're looking at these deals. Cause like you're underwriting it from a true underwriting perspective. Whereas from what you do, and I'm doing it from this marketing acquisition perspective, and the speed has been fun to watch that. That's been really cool.
It's a fun place to be, because I think the traditional financial way that you underwrite the financial way where you figure out what a business is worth, whether it's discounted cash flows or a comparative company analysis, I don't think that there are a lot of people that are kind of looking at these businesses in that lens of, what is this thing worth and how can I drive the value in it? And so from our perspective, kind of our investment thesis as we're doing this is, we think that we're looking at things that no one else really classifies as an asset yet, that, you know, with funnels and with a lot of the marketing tools and tactics that you know, and like that whole art and science on that side of things, that we can turn these things into assets that will eventually be valued like how conventional assets get valued. And so we're figuring it out.
But the way we've been doing, because I have my view on things, my lens, and I'm always like, oh man, I want to go build, like half the reason I built the studio was so that we could film the show Business Syndicate. And instead of it being Shark Tank, where you just give money, which is a little more traditional, you know, path that at least is publicized on the TV, I would be giving funnels and talents that way. And so it's cool to see the marriage of this and how it actually fits together. But you said something to me that I was hoping you could kind of explain a little bit, because I think a lot of people will have come from my mindset on what M&A is or how they would see funnels playing in it. But you said something to me, as well as some of these other investors in the deal we just did, that like, this isn't normal. Like what we're doing is not a normal thing. How is traditional growth equity done, you know, in mergers and acquisitions, where compared to how you and I are doing it with funnels? Because I think most people are not going to understand that they have a cool funnel, but they definitely don't have a business, but there's a neat place we could all help each other here.
One of the things you learn very quickly when you're doing M&A deals, and I had the ability to advise as a lawyer, and then especially in public company deals, you can kind of see how the transaction plays out over time and whether it made money or it didn't make money. Most of the time when you're looking at a traditional M&A deal, you almost never assume it. It gets really risky if you assume that you're going to grow revenue in the business or that you're going to capture synergies, that you're going to capture what's called revenue synergies, that if we're company A that's selling paper and you're company B that's selling journals, you know, we're going to be able to cross-sell our customers. And because of that cross-selling, we're going to make revenue alchemy and we're going to make way more because we're going to be able to cross-sell. You can almost never price that into a deal. It's almost always a beginner mistake to assume that you're going to really drive revenue in a big way conventionally. So you almost always price acquisitions looking at it of how we're going to do cost synergies, how we're going to save costs, how we're going to, you know, cut people and really simplify the business from a cost standpoint. The thing that was different as we looked at this business that we bought was I felt very confident that having you involved and your skill set, that revenue was most definitely going to grow and expand, and we were going to drive revenue value that way through funnels and by taking the skill set and creating break-even customers at the front end of, you know, them getting to know us in our business. And so that in and of itself was interesting. And the other difficult piece that most people find when they build a course business and they build it around themselves, that one of the hardest parts about buying a business like this is that it's so built around the attractive character, the person who's out in front, who's using their personality to drive this thing. And so the way that we structured it, where we kept the attractive character in the business and, you know, made sure that she had a massively substantial piece for a second transaction that we'll do later on down the road, while also having enough equity in the business. You know, we bought 2/3 of the business, and she kept 1/3 of the business. And so keeping her massively financially incentivized while also giving us enough of the business that it's incentivizing for us, I think that is a structure that, like, I think we'll use more and more, and I think people will copy that eventually and use that as a structure to try to get exposure to these type of businesses.
That's what he said. It was he said, hey, if I had you, I'd say yes to deals that otherwise would have to say no to. And it's because of what you're talking about, right? That the revenue growth piece. I think the part that's been so fun for me is I've been using the same formula that I've created, you know, over the last 5-6 years and really perfected. And Raleigh's had to coach me like crazy on some of these pieces. The first time we ever met with the person that we acquired, it was very obvious that I was coaching her rather than pretending like she's a client. And this has been a weird mentality shift for me that, like, oh, as owners of the business, we will do this instead of, should probably go do that. That's been fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had to learn this as well. When I, you know, my whole goal is to own 50 of these, right? And so one of the hardest pieces, even if all of the financials work out and it's in a market that feels like it's hard to, you know, it's in a market that has a moat around it and you have an attractive character in there that seems like they're going to be massively involved. One of the important things is, you know, I've learned that if you set the incentives correctly, if everyone's properly incentivized working towards the same goal and there's not perverse incentives where, like, heads I win, tails you lose type of thing amongst the partnership and the passive partners and the owner, that you can grow a really big business and you can grow multiple big businesses at the same time. And so it's important as we look at these, right, that we find businesses that don't require us to, like, come in and take up every piece of the org chart in order for it to get going the right way. A lot of people, when they're in the M&A world, is they make the mistake by going after the cheapest assets possible, right? They want something that's distressed and they want something that's trending the wrong way because they can get it on the cheap. And the exchange that you make for a cheap deal like that is you're going to spend a massive amount of your time trying to reverse the momentum in the business and get it right-sized and moving in the right direction. And so it's going to be hard to find deals that, like, all the boxes get checked so perfectly.
Yeah.
Like this one, this
deal, like, that.
This is, like, this is like a home run out of the park deal. And so it's been fun to do. But I think partnering with the right people and getting involved in the right businesses with people that are still excited about it going forward and open to bring new partners in. I think that's an important piece that we got right on this one.
I mean, so we've talked a little bit of the strategy with the unique, but why don't we share some of the deal, like how it went down, how this stuff happened, because that was fun to walk through. And I also want to just bring up with this that listen to the numbers he's about to say, because anytime, and there's a huge stigma, especially for entrepreneurs who were born in funnel land, to think that any kind of merger or acquisition thing is like this, you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars that's coming from your pocket. You know, it's your, you know what I mean? Or massive bank loans. The way I watched you orchestrate it was an education, an entire education in and of itself, regardless of doing it and all the other things that we're doing with it. So I was hoping that we could go through and share some of the numbers, you know, and to also kind of prime the thoughts of anyone who's listening or watching now that like M&A is not outside of your reach if you're not making millions of dollars.
I had met the owner of this business because she felt like she was stuck in her business and she didn't know how to get to the next level. And so she wanted help kind of transitioning to the next level of either exiting the business or bringing partners in. And so I had known of the deal since August that she and we were helping her start selling the business. And I had seen it and I was always interested in the deal, but it felt like there was a piece of it that I didn't know how to solve. What, you know, she sells through a webinar. She teaches pharmacists how to become genetic testers on the side of their pharmacy job. And so it felt like in order to really take the business to the next level, it was a marketing and an operations job that I wasn't well suited to do. And so I was never really interested in it until me and you started talking about doing acquisitions ourselves. You know, these deals are typically valued based on kind of what the last 12-month snapshot of the business looked like. It's called the trailing 12 months of the business, TTM. And so the trailing 12 months of her business, when I got associated with it, is it was doing about $300,000 to $350,000 in revenue, but she had never turned on paid ads. She was selling it through a webinar. It was kind of her first crack at entrepreneurship. And she, you know.
Hey, I hope you're enjoying the episode. Let me interrupt for just 1 minute here. One time I was speaking on the stage at this event, this guy picked up a microphone and he said, "Steve, when do Facebook ads begin paying off?" And I remember looking confused and just asking back, like, "What do you mean?" He repeated the question and said, "Well, we've been spending a lot of money on Facebook ads for a long time now, and we're just wondering when this begins to all pay off, when we actually start making money from the ad." I said, "Wait, Facebook ads are not an investment. They don't pay off someday. This is direct response marketing. So if we don't get a payoff within the first few days, we turn off the ads. How much money have you spent?" I will never forget the look at this guy's face as he realized he had the completely wrong mindset about ads. And he said, "We've spent over $250,000 without any return on ads at all." My stomach fell out of my body. Look, this is direct response marketing, meaning we measure the direct response of our marketing. That's why ads are the holy grail of marketing. They're not an investment that pays off someday, sorry colleges, because every dollar spent on ads should return with another dollar very soon. That's what my good friend John Parks and I are doing, the Chief Ads Officer Workshop on May 15th through the 17th. John has spent over $150 million in Facebook ads profitably and manages the ads accounts for some of the biggest names out there. John is going to take 50 business owners through his unique Facebook ads process while you follow along. At the end, you're going to have your own account running. I simply asked John to show us what's working best today in the ads world right now. John told me that one of the hardest parts of running ads today is finding the right person to do it. Traditional org charts don't really have a spot for the ad buyer, so this workshop will help you install a new role, whether in-house or if you go higher, the new role of Chief Ads Officer inside your business. This workshop is both for those who want to learn ads themselves or for those who want to learn to communicate with their media buyer better. The workshop is only happening one time in person in my event studio in Boise, Idaho, May 15th through the 17th, and all the details are at chiefadsofficer.com. Go to chiefadsofficer.com right now to save your seat and get more details. We can't wait to see you there. Let's get back to the episode.
Off of the 300,000, she was doing like $250,000 in profit. That's not what she thought that she was doing. When she first came to me, she thought that she was doing about $100,000 in profit because she didn't know that her salary and any course that she bought through the business All those things are called owner add back. So like you kind of adjust the profitability of the business to show what it, how profitable it would be to a new owner. It's called an adjusted EBITDA. And so from an adjusted EBITDA standpoint, she was doing about $250,000 to $270,000 a year. But she was just tired. She didn't know how to get to the next step, right? And she felt like she had spent some money on marketers and some operations people, and none of it had really panned out. So she was kind of just like ready to move on to the next thing. So the deal that we ultimately did with her was we bought 2/3 of her business for $100,000, our cash up front that she took off of the table. There was $100,000 of operating cash that was in the business. She took 90 of that herself. So she made 190 grand that she took off the table. Me and you put an additional $30,000 into the operating account of the new company. It's called NewCo. So for about $130,000 of new cash, 100 of it, she took off the table, 30 into the new business. We bought 2/3 of the business that was doing conservatively somewhere in the $250,000 in profit range. From our account, you know, I felt like it was such a no-brainer deal that I had people that were potential capital partners that would be ecstatic to have a return on their money similar to what this deal could provide. And so I brought, you know, we basically sold 20% of our piece of the business to a couple of they're called limited partners. That's part of the way that we brought cash to the table for her. And, you know, and obviously we're in the business and helping her make decisions and optimizing the marketing and everything else to take it to a $10 million business.
To me, it's a no-brainer. I'm looking at this thing and I'm like, okay, we're going to go there. This is going to be fun. This will be cool. And this is, and which is unique for me. And it's something I've really been hungry for because I've have a lot of experience and y'all know Washington, you know, and now they're listening now, like how, I mean, in one funnel way, it was 50,000 students I brought through that. It's crazy. And in like a year and a half, like I have been very hungry to go really deep with people. And I just have never had a lane to do it in where I also would get, you know, a little kickback for the improvement in the business itself. And so it's been a fun, interesting thing for me. I want to be able to also take note of how, you know, we're not talking millions of dollars here. And now we get to run the whole run. Like I can do all my frameworks and formulas. We're cranking. We're already doing well with it. In fact, today, as we're filming this, we got the funnel back that I designed and that we're putting it back out there. Raleigh's working on financial stuff now and then looking for the next deals.
One of the things that she felt really stuck in was doing the accounting and doing the financial work in the business. And so I think a lot of times people think, like you said, that it's that in order to acquire something, it's going to be millions of dollars. And I think also a lot of times people think that an acquisition is like you're taking somebody's business from them. It's like confiscatory, when really it was much more it's always been a collaborative process with this person, because she felt stuck and she felt like she knew that there was potential in the business that she was all alone and trying to harvest and shepherd too. And, you know, we came in and said, what if we let you take cash off of the table now for the hard work that you've done? And, you know, we help you shepherd it to the next level and we participate there.
Well, what I imagine is in some people's minds, as they're kind of observing this between the two of us, and so it'd probably be a few epiphanies for some people. Wow, I didn't realize this is where maybe Funneland could take me, you know. A lot of my fault. This is sales funnel radio, right? That, you know, that we, you guys build funnels, and a lot of you guys build funnels where what there's a 2 Comma Club award almost every day, literally. And it's been that way for a couple of years. How many $100,000 earners are there in funnel space? There are so many, multiple every day, tons every single day. And only a few, are hitting 7 figures a day. Like there's a ton of scenarios out there. And, I get messages from some of you guys like, hey, Steve, you want to come buy my business? Just on the blue. And so what I kind of wanted to ask you is like, all right, I've never had to do this before, but you're like, Steven, I need you to market underwrite. What do you do to underwrite? What makes a business look attractive to you from your side of the fence?
For me, I look at 4 areas. I look at what is the growth, and it's GOAT, G-O-A-T. What's the growth of the business look like? How much has it grown year over year? And what does that trajectory look like? And also, how is that growth accomplished? Are they using steroids, which I would call kind of paid advertising and, you know, ways that you can kind of game growth? Or is it organic? Is it word of mouth? Obviously, the more organic, the better. Operations is O. What do the operations of the business look like? Is it tight? How involved is the owner in the operations of the business? The accounting of the business, how is it accounted for? Do they run a tight ship, tight books? How do the books look in the business, basically? And then the fourth is the trenches. What are the trenches? How defensible is the business? How hard is it for someone to spin up a competitor to this business quickly and take it to the next level? And then, you know, kind of the fifth one is it a type of deal that if we're right on it, we get rich, and if we're wrong, we don't go broke? That if we really hit this properly, based on the size of the business and what we think it could grow to, will it be substantial for us? And then if we're wrong about everything, will it put anyone in a financial position that really screws them? and so I look at those four. I look at GOAT, and then right, you get rich, wrong, you don't go broke. And if it checks all of them, then we go for it, figure it out.
It's a cool way to think of it, because I think what most people would immediately go to is financials or, you know, acquisition cost. And not those things certainly matter, but that's a neat way to look at that. Now, but if you guys are interested, though, if you want to learn more about what it is, actually, I would love to hear what your vision is of it. Because I feel like there's an entire market being created where people create sustainable, to a level, sustainable small businesses, info or not, but they're small. And they just literally, the entrepreneur took it as far as they can. They don't know what to do next. And it's where we could swoop in. I could still do my thing. You could do your thing, and everyone wins. People are already asking you when we're going to make a fund.
Yeah.
So I would love to know what your vision is for where this could go. Just pontificating.
It's called permanent capital, more so than a fund. A fund, typically you're raising the money with the expectation to return it at some multiple within 5 to 7 years, versus a permanent capital model where people buy into who the operating team is, and they know that their money will compound better there in the structure to let us go and do acquisitions and own great businesses over a long time horizon, more so than raising a fund and then, you know, you give us $100,000 and we give you back $250,000 in 4 years or whatever. I like the long-term compounding effect of a permanent capital structure like a Berkshire Hathaway. And so I think what we'll move to more and more is finding businesses like this one that we just bought, which isn't a promotion, you know, it's not a promotion business that's just like you juice it and then it tanks. I think there's long-term sustainability and growth in this market. And I think that the business that we bought, like, I plan to hold this business for 20 years, not 2 years. And that gives us the time and the expectation to really scale it how we want to scale it, knowing that, you know, there's a long time horizon for us to compound this and to continue to add businesses that fits in.
I think it helps the owners also be like excited, you know? They know that we're not there to juice, like this is a long-term thing. Cause you were the first one to help me realize that trying to acquire a business percentage for free is kind of a dumb thing.
and it's not
a smart move.
I got that.
It's attractive as crap on the sales page.
I got that from Warren Buffett. I didn't come up with that myself, but Warren Buffett calls it smoking like used cigarette butts, that he would, you know, at the very beginning. And the quote that Warren Buffett says is it's much better to own a wonderful business at a fair price than a fair business at a wonderful price. And so you optimize for the quality of the business much more than you do the price at which you enter. And he does it in the public markets. And so, you know, he has to do it because public markets are always waxing and waning, and they're going up and they're going down. And so for him, you know, he's thinking about, is this a business that I want to be a part of for the next 20 years? And is it run by somebody that I like, that I want to, you know, live a fair portion of my life with? And I think the longer time horizon you give yourself for an investment and for a return, the chances that you win on a long enough time horizon are really good. People get themselves into trouble because they say, well, I got this for free. Sure, I hate working with this person, but like, I got it for free and like hopefully I can like flip a profit in 6 months. And if you're at the beginning stages of the game, that may be a game that you have to play. But when you get any sort of success and like stability in your life and you don't have to play that game anymore, I don't think it's a game that's worth playing because there are so many losers in that game versus a long time horizon game with great quality assets run by great operators that, you know, have a long-term view towards how they want to build it into the future.
Because you had to rip me from that. I was like, man, we could get this many this fast or whatever. Like, you know, you're like, that's dumb. Like, just slap that milkshake right out of my hand. And that was like, all right, sounds good. They're like, no, you're spot on. And I was so, you know, there's other influencers in the space who shall not be named until future episodes where we gain the gumption. That go out and push like this whole acquire businesses for nothing. And there's a lot of people that do it. And your whole skin in the game thing too. I know that's from a book, but like, I mean, I just never seen anyone pull it off that way. I've been around M&A quite a bit. I just have never gone down a lane. And you got like a really unique take, you personally too, I think.
Even to the like, to the no money down thing, I think skin in the game as just a guiding principle is such an important, I think the decisions that you make and the quality of decisions that you get with people that can lose some money, get people at the table that are going to lose some money if the decision's not right. If no matter, that's like in every business, a business that I've started from scratch, a business that I've acquired, I only want people at the table that are losing real dollars if we're wrong about something. It's the refiner's fire, right? It gets all the other bullshit out. And it helps you focus on what is the right decision and are we equally sharing in the loss in this? It's almost religious to me where it's a disservice to have somebody at the table that is a consultant or a lawyer or an advisor or a carpetbagger in any other way that is just there and makes money on the upside and can walk out the door on the downside and is not, and you know, can walk away unscathed. I like people that are going to feel the pain with me. And those people deserve to feel the success with me too. I've learned that from running my trampoline park business, and to the extent possible, anytime that I can. I think decisions are better made. I know in the investments that I've done, I've gotten equity and investments for free before. And when those entrepreneurs call because it's hitting the fan or whatever, I don't pick up their phone calls. Versus the investments that I got 25, 50, 100 grand into, when those entrepreneurs call because they want help for whatever reason, like I answer their phone calls.
You know, you're right there.
Because yeah. I want my money back.
Yeah. It's tough to watch when someone who's kind of gone from scratch, go through all the funnel stuff or whatever, and they birth this thing, and then someone else can step in and take a chunk of equity and not get any kind of reward, not any getting a payout, like the emotion behind that, not the saying it's wrong, but like there's no, it leaves a lot of mental cookie and juice for the next journey. Like I think sucks it out, just totally destroys it. That would be very disheartening for me.
If you've ever read The Alchemist, which if you haven't, I suggest that you do, but at the very beginning of The Alchemist, he has this dream about all this treasure that he's going to get. And he goes to this gypsy woman who interprets this dream and says, I'll tell you about this dream if you give me 10% of the treasure. And he says, sure, like it's no money out of my pocket. Sure, I'll give you 10%. Like it's just a stupid dream. Why not? And then he goes to the next person who happens to be Melchizedek, who's kind of like the spiritual guide in the book. And Melchizedek is a king and he's got all this stuff. And he says, well, in order for me to give you the next step of this, you know, I want 30% of your sheep. And he says, well, how about I give you another 10% of my treasure if I ever get it? And Melchizedek says, don't ever give up something that you don't have yet because you'll lose the will to continue to fight for it if you keep giving up pieces and pieces for free. And so quit giving up this contingent treasure that you may get because you'll lose the will to fight for it. And so Melchizedek, who had all of the money in the world, made this little kid, this little shepherd boy, give up a big portion of his sheep, you know, real cost. Real skin in the game associated with pursuing this dream. And so I just think it's, like I said, I really do think it's like a refiner's fire and it helps kind of separate the people that are serious about going after the thing that they want versus the people that are just there for the upside and, you know, bail on the downside.
Yeah, completely agree with that. And it's been fun to watch that. And even when I get brand new funnel builders who are students who have not yet burned the boats in their life, I can know that they're not, you know what I mean? They're just not going to move forward. The first little kind of emotional hiccup that pops up, they'll dismiss the entire model. And then, you know, and it's like, oh, you come to find out that person, no skin in the game or any kind of variant. And then the person has no choice. They just figured out because they have no choice.
It's the people that say, can you give me your course for free? And I'll give you 20% of everything that I earn if you just give it to me for free, right?
Like, they don't do anything with it.
They won't do anything.
They'll do the thing. Right? It's crazy. I started saying I charge for your benefit now, but that almost sounds offensive. So I'll say that as much. But, well, hey, man, I'm really excited for this. I'm stoked for the journey. Like, I haven't felt this much momentum in years, actually, and it's been really fun. If you guys are interested in us just looking at your business, if you have any interest at all, this isn't a pitch, but the place to go get more info is at businesssyndicate.com. And it's just a simple form there to fill out, and no pressure, nothing like that. We won't buy you if you're not great anyway. So no pressure at all, but that's what we've been up to, and excited to share more lessons and stuff on the way.
Hey, if you're unaware, stevejlarson.com is my hub for all things that I'm involved with. If you want more traffic, offers, funnels, launches, content, leads, or if you'd like some consulting, actually, if you even want to rent our studio for your challenge or event or have me on your show, it's actually all on stevejlarson.com. There's also a contact link, of course, and we actually call that page type that you'll see there a hero funnel, or I call it a PR funnel, because it highlights all the common PR questions. Now, I only bring that up because this is a show called Sales Funnel Radio, but that's what you'll see when you go there. If you're not sure where to start in this internet marketing world, stevejlarson.com has a list of great resources and education links for you. I even have a little Easter egg Atari game that I paid someone to make in the footer called Funnel Heroes. You'll see it there at stevejlarson.com.